Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Up Hollywood, this is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula, and tonight we have a very special guest, one of the most intelligent people I know, my brother Anish Kalula. We're going to comment on some of his political blog stuff, and we're going to also talk about the debate that just happened. Let's just jump right in. This is even better than calling you right afterwards. Anish, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing all right.
Well, I'm good, man. What did you think of the debate, dude?
There was a Twitter picture that summarized the debate up very well. It was like two old guys, and it said one old guy yells at other old guy. So that was basically that was the gist of the debate. It was neither one were there was no real policy discussions. It was, I think, both campaigns told Trump and Biden just, you know, this is all the stuff you need to hurl at the other person. Just do it as quickly as possible. So that's essentially what happened. And Chris Wallace used to have a good reputation as a pretty good moderator, but he couldn't control two old guys. So I don't know. Hopefully the next debate moderator will do a better job.
Yeah, you know, I was really kind of disappointed that he was just kind of like allowing some of the kind of the jargon, you know, just like, you know, Trump was interrupting Biden a lot. Biden was also kind of like also trying to jab back. It was just kind of like not a very clean debate that it should have been. How do you think?
It wasn't a very good advertisement for American democracy. I mean, we're the richest country in the world. I mean, at least even in political campaigns in England, it's mostly people in the audience who are like citizens asking questions of prime ministers, and that's the way it should be done.
Right.
I mean, most debates now are mostly like, let's make a deal or some sort of like game show style theatrics where they're all campaigns, and the consultants tell the candidates, you need to use a zinger, try this line when he mentions this or when she mentions that. So do I think it's people were educated or anything? No. I think people, if you like Trump, you'll vote for him. If you like Biden, you'll vote for Biden. And very few people who are independents, I think people have already made up their minds. So I don't think it's really going to move the needle either way, unless one of them, you know, stumbles or drools during a debate. I don't think anything's really going to change. You know,
how would you kind of we'll start with Trump first. How would you judge each of their performances just on like how they kind of took on the opportunity to either talk about their own policies or either to, you know, kind of attack their opponent?
Well, this election is mostly a referendum on Trump. So if you were Biden, you would need to say, this is what Trump did. This is what he did. This is what he should be doing. And that you make it about him. But Trump was smart in the sense that, but Trump is also very clumsy. He's not a very good debater. He's not very disciplined. He doesn't know when to shut up, like when Biden said. So he doesn't do a very good job. But again, if you like Trump, you're going to vote for him. If you like Biden, you're going to vote for him. And people who dislike Trump are going to vote for, like, Biden is the nominee, not because people think Biden's going to be a great leader. It's because Biden is a brand name that was associated with another very more popular brand name, President Obama. And they're hoping that was going to, you know, bring them across the finish line. But I don't think this debate did a very good job of convincing people to vote if they were undecided. Most of what I read and got texts from friends, they all said it was just a dumpster fire, and it didn't do a good job of, you know, pointing out the issues, you know, taxation, COVID, corruption, that sort of thing. No one talked about any of that stuff. It was just, it was essentially like that Simpsons cartoon, one old guy yells at another old guy.
What was one of the pressing issues that you wanted either candidate to talk about?
Well, one of the issues was obviously COVID and when they're going to expect the economy to get back up and running, because there are a lot of people who are out of work. The people who work in Silicon Valley, Wall Street, Hollywood, all are fairly wealthy and make enough money that they can work from home. But there are a lot of people in the service economy and other aspects of the American economy that need to actually go to a physical location to work. I don't think the gig economy and Grubhub and Postmates is going to sustain families and help people earn money. It should be like earning money on the side. And then they never talked about foreign policy in the Middle East in terms of pulling troops out of Afghanistan. When are they going to do that? They didn't focus on the debt and how to, and they focused on like court packing, but it was mostly just, you know, hurling insults at each other. I was very disappointed. Hopefully the next two debates will be a little bit better in terms of having more meaty, substantive policy discussions, because that's what people really want to hear.
Right. I thought, you know, there were moments where, you know, Biden really could have like kind of threw some information about his taxes and things really under the microscope that he didn't really go after. And I also thought Trump kind of, you know, had some like low blows with like, you know, kind of attacking his son and trying to throw like this propaganda. You know, these debates are like a vehicle for the American public to kind of see, you know, how these candidates can kind of deal with, you know, each other under pressure. And I don't feel like either of them kind of succeeded. But what did you find from the answers that they gave that was a positive on either side?
I don't think there was too much. I mean, I'm still recording and I'm watching part of it now, but they didn't really focus on the what people want to know is, am I going to be able to pay my bills? Am I going to be able to, the stimulus package, the most people, you know, it took a while for some people to get their stimulus checks, and that's $1,200. That's not enough to help pay the bills. Whereas there's been a lot of fraud with the patient protection PPP, and a lot of companies and large corporations were given payouts. Instead, that money should have gone to a middle company, and I wished they had focused on that. But, you know, these political presidential candidates are mostly propped up by corporations and mega donors. And, most of the people who are supporting Biden are not supporting Biden because they like him, because he is the anti-Trump candidate. So that's basically... And I was very upset that they didn't talk about what financial relief they're going to provide for lower income people who desperately need help.
Right. You know, the funny thing is, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but you have so much like, you know, experience in politics. And, you know, I love talking politics with you because, you know, I'm kind of like one of those, you know, people that just kind of gets some surface articles about things that are going on in politics. And when I hear like, you know, you talking about politics, you're so well read on so many different sides of an issue. You know, so it's like whenever I ask you about certain things and I may have an opinion, you have so much, you know, material that you've gathered to formulate your own opinion. And I always respect your opinion so much because, you know, even though I know you're, you know, a staunch Democrat, you also criticize your own party, whereas, you know, a lot of people don't criticize their own parties for those same reasons. So what would you like to say, or what do you think, in your best opinion, the Democrats could work more on to kind of like bolster their chances or just to get the best candidates or even their policies that they want to, you know, accomplish?
Well, I mean, I wish the Democrats would go back to, like, I'm not a staunch Democrat. I lean Democrat. I'm not opposed to Republicans as long as they have good ideas that are going to benefit most Americans. You need to support, you need to bring back the middle class, provide economic relief for people who need it rather than large corporations. And I think Clinton's victory in 1992 brought the Democrats out of the wilderness because they had lost Jimmy Carter in 80, and then they lost three consecutive presidential elections, two very, very convincingly. and Clinton brought them out of the woods. And I think they treated Clinton like a savior. And Clinton told them, look, we can also go meet with corporations too. And I think Clinton was the first Democratic presidential candidate and president who actively cultivated relationships with the business community, which is good. But the Democrats, I wish, would go back to being a party that looks after the middle class and the lower income Americans, because now you just essentially have two parties that cater to the wealthy elite, Silicon Valley, Wall Street, oil and gas industry. And a lot of these cities and towns in the Midwest and around the country are slowly being decimated because they're losing business, jobs are being shipped overseas. And for all intents and purposes, there are 100 million Americans who are eligible to vote but do not vote because they either don't care, they see no real advantage. And those are the people you need to cultivate and get them to vote rather than, you know, ignoring them and focusing on identity politics. They need to figure out why these people are not voting, what would get them to vote. And if you provide opportunities, give people opportunities to go to college, if they want to go to college. I personally am starting to believe now that you don't need to go to college unless you're going for a specific, you know, degree. Like if you're going to become a dentist, a lawyer, an engineer, or something along those lines that requires specialization. Otherwise, you should just go to a junior college, learn how to do Excel and learn how to do business accounting, basic business accounting, have some understanding of analysis, and spend $150,000 to $200,000 to get a degree. I mean, USC, we're both USC alums, and USC is a great school, but it's ridiculously expensive.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about, education reform, I think, is super important in this country. You know, a lot of countries around the world, they don't charge what the U.S. does as far as higher education is concerned.
And yeah, I think part of that is because they got a lot of, like, you know, they go after all of these specialized consultants, you know, to recruit students, you know, student recruiter. Athletics is very expensive. So when you pay coaches $7 to $10 million a year, you have to jack up tuition. Everyone's fallback in universities is tuition increases because no one really cares about the students as long as they get tuition money. And so I think you need to, I don't think college should be free, but if you go to a four-year college, it shouldn't cost more than maybe $50,000 for 4 years. So you have to try and do it in such a way where it's maybe $15,000 a year, which is more doable. And then if you want to go, and you can, if you do it for $50,000 to $60,000, you can pay it off within a short period of time, and then you can buy a home. A lot of people go to college, they get these degrees, then they'll get master's degrees and undergrad, which will probably total $250,000. That's $250,000. And people don't have opportunities to buy homes or try and build up savings and financial liquid assets because they're too busy paying off loans.
Yeah, so, and you know, the funny thing is it's, you know, these diplomas sometimes don't necessarily lead to careers for a lot of these kids that are coming out of schools. There's a statistic that I recently saw that a lot of college grads are out of work because, you know, there's been such a high influx and focus on kids getting a higher education. And so some of these blue collar jobs that actually, you know, like electricians and plumbers, there's, you know, there's a lack of people kind of getting those kind of careers because they've been kind of maybe duped into thinking, oh, I'm supposed to go to college and get this education. And then there's
economy. That's why I think you need to bring back guidance counselors at high schools and say, what do you want to do? You don't, even if you're book smart and you have the aptitude, you score well on the SAT, you shouldn't go to college unless you know what you want to do. So that means if you work in retail for a year or two out after high school and you figure out what you want to do, and then you should show high school kids, this is what it requires. If you want to write code and work in computer science, this is the aptitude you need. This is what you're going to do. So you should give kids an opportunity to figure out if they have an aptitude, if they're going to like it. There are lots of people who go to medical school. You and I both know people who have gone to medical school, have become doctors, and they don't really like what they do because there's a lot of societal and maybe family pressure to go into that. And you should let kids do what they want to do. You're going to need tech people, but you're also going to need people in the medical industry. You're going to need social workers. There are different opportunities, and you have to find out what is available. And society doesn't tends to value jobs that are glamorous, like lawyer, Wall Street, business exec, Silicon Valley exec. You know, they don't value professions that are needed, like the police, fire departments, education, teachers. You should value these positions and, you know, bring back respect to those jobs. And you'll get a lot of intelligent people in the teaching profession. Right now, I don't know if they do that across the board. I know there are a lot of passionate people who are teachers. I know some, you know some. But if you value the teacher and pay the respect, they don't have the money. Maybe instead of having school districts pay the salaries, they're state employees. And I don't know how it works. I know some school districts are very wealthy, like Arcadia is a very wealthy school district. I don't know if Pasadena is. I don't know if Temple City. So certain school districts don't have the money. But if you want good teachers in those schools, and then you also need to teach kids to respect teachers, and because otherwise it's difficult. Now I think the state of California passed a law that says you cannot discipline a disruptive student because it could be...
There's all kinds of sensitive, you know, issues at play.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't discipline a disruptive kid, the entire class pays the price for that day. So you need to have teachers and give them the authority. You need to find ways for parents to take care of societal problems that need to be repaired. But I think instead of forcing kids to go to college, you need to find opportunities for them to make a living. You know, if you become a plumber and you own your own plumbing company and you do it correctly, you can make a lot of money. Same thing if you own like HVAC, air conditioning, heater, you can make a lot of money. It's not glamorous, but it puts food on the table and you can earn a decent living doing that. But we don't focus on getting kids to these jobs because they're not glamorous. And people like TV, popular culture only glamorizes like musicians or actors, all are very, very necessary jobs, but you need to give people an opportunity to see what other jobs are out there.
Well, do you think that's the illusion of capitalism? Because it's like, as I've become an older American citizen, I've kind of like lost a little bit of faith in capitalism, you know, on a grand scale.
You need to allow capitalism is good. It lifts more people out of poverty than any form of economic, you know, model for a society. But runaway capitalism is a problem, which is what we have in this country. You know, I read an article, I think it was in the New York Times, how a lot of these oil and gas companies, before they go out of business, the boards essentially approve massive payouts to executives. So the executives all get paid and the board gets payment too. And then the company goes out of business and all these people lose jobs. So hyper-capitalism is a problem. And, you know, large companies laying off people while allowing executives to get bonuses should, if you're going to lay off people, you shouldn't get a bonus.
I totally agree. And I find that you know, like in the music industry, it's like that as well. You very much have a 1% and a 99%, and it's happening. It like that trickle down effect, you know, never really happens. You just see the divide in, you know, society becoming greater. And I see that in government. I see that in corporate thinking. I just feel like capitalism as a whole is very lopsided at the moment. Is there a way that you think maybe a political candidate or a policy can kind of curb or change that?
You need to have someone who doesn't hate capitalism, but has to convince people that you need to have something in place to correct the quality of life for people who are not wealthy. So as much as I don't agree with Nina Turner on a lot of things, I think she used to be a state legislator in Ohio, and she's fierce and she's not afraid to mix it up with people. She doesn't have a lot of fear, but I would like to see her be a governor or some sort of leadership position before she runs for president, because she understands that capitalism is bad, but you definitely need to have something in place to protect workers with companies. And I think you need to have someone who's going to convince people that capitalism is good, but if anything goes unchecked, it becomes bad. So having some sort of safety net for people is good, but making it socialist or communist is not good. So you need to have You need to have moderate capitalism with some sort of system that protects people and gives them a quality of life that doesn't make life difficult. So if you make $1 million a year, you should have a flat tax of maybe 20%. If you make less than 50,000, your tax burden is lower. And then that money has to go, if you raise X amount of money that has to go to education, it has to go to education. Because like the California lottery, they'll say this money can go to education and fund schools, but it's not guaranteed to go there. It can be used for education. But what usually happens is all the lottery money goes to fill up it's used to go and fill up issues and budget holes in other departments. So if you tax people on this, like sales tax, this must go to this and it must not waver. And so you must have good public transportation. You must have good police. You must have good education. And you should also tax moderately capital gains, which is usually how rich people earn their money. Usually, you know, they have it in stocks, bonds, dividends, etc. So if you make money on capital gains right now, if you have a good tax accounting, you can pay next to nothing. So you should pay something like maybe 12% on capital gains. And if you make $5 million off capital gains and you tax it 12%, you still keep most of it. So I think you need to do something like that. But most of the tax law is written by members of Congress on behalf of large corporations and wealthy people. So the IRS is constantly being burdened with new tax laws, not because it's required, because members of Congress do stuff because corporations and wealthy people want loopholes. And so you can't do that. You have to allow people, if you make a lot of money, you should be able to make money, but you should be able to tax them moderately, not excessively. Because what usually happens is, even Mick Jagger, I think, with the Rolling Stones, said one of the reasons why he left living in England is because the excessive taxation was difficult for him and it was a burden. So you need to have some taxation and you need to lower government expenditures in some areas, but you'd have to have someone who takes a deep dive to look at the minutiae and get rid of programs that are not needed, get rid of pork, which is usually bloated, government programs for members of Congress, congressional districts and constituents. So you should get rid of that, which I think they've done. And Obama passed a bill that I think it was called the Stock Act, which basically means a member of Congress could no longer invest in stock companies and make trades because they all have access to information that other people don't. So you need to kind of clean out corruption. And one of the other things they should do is what they do now in terms of corruption is companies will eventually give jobs to the children or family members of Congress, which is what they do. And so that's effectively a wave of greasing the wheels, and you should not do that either.
Now, do you think, I always have a problem with whatever political party on both sides. I feel like, every political candidate or position gets greased with whatever corporations are funding their campaigns to push policies that they may not necessarily believe in, but because they're getting funded.
Yeah.
How can we curb that? Because at the end of the day, the country as a whole, not run itself into the ground because of a certain corporation, no matter what the corporation is, that kind of guides the political system. Is there a way that we can kind of limit a corporation's kind of control over political candidates in general?
You have to kind of, if you do that, you have to limit the amount of money that goes into politics. I mean, you cannot not have any money to run for office, but you need to limit the amount of money that people can give. So you have to figure out, I think when you do your taxes, you can, I think $3 of your tax returns goes to, or whatever amount, I can't remember the exact amount, but it goes to a presidential campaign. So if you run for president, you can get a certain amount of money, and everyone must adhere to spending limits, but a lot of people don't want to adhere to spending limits because the corporations and wealthy people who give money want, they want their side to win. And politics now is such a zero-sum game that if you're a liberal, you give money to Democrats and you don't want any sort of compromise. If you're a conservative, you give money to Republicans and you don't want any compromise. So when you have wealthy benefactors giving you money and say, don't compromise, it's hard to get anything done because those people who give money, those entities that give money have so much influence. Like when Obama won, I think someone had given him suggestions of who to have in his cabinet. And I think the banking industry had given him a list of names of people who could be Treasury Secretary and other. So these corporations have massive amounts of influence, and they give a lot of money through individual donations and like lump payments to political parties and political action committees. So they definitely want, they don't want too many restrictions on their business model, and they want to be left alone. And I can understand people should be able to make money, but it should not be like runaway train, like capitalism, but you should also limit the excesses. So I think you need to take money out of politics or reduce it to a level that is manageable, so people are not beholden to corporate interests. Because if you raise $1 billion to run for president or $2 billion, A, there's no way anyone running for president, you don't need $2 billion. That's
right.
I mean, that's kind of a joke. That means no individual person would care about anything, because if you need that much money, it's most of it's going to come from the corporate world anyway. So you need to reduce the amount of money you need to run for president, and you need to have policies that, you know, because most politicians now have to spend a good chunk of their time dialing for dollars.
Right.
One of the guys I worked for, Steve Israel, who's a nice guy, he's no longer in Congress. He left because he was tired of, I think he was an 8-term Congress. So he was in Congress for 16 years, and he got tired of dialing for dollars. I mean, you spend a good chunk of your time, I would say at least 40% to 45%, maybe more for some people, you know, just calling people and asking for money. And that's absurd. Members of Congress and people who serve in Congress should not have to be doing that.
Right.
So there has to be something where if you run for Congress, the most you can raise is, I don't know, $1.5 million, which is like the average. But for some Senate races, it's a lot, like $20 to $30 million, and sometimes it can go up to $70 million, which is ridiculous. If you raise that kind of money, there's no way that you're going to be loyal to the vast majority of people who are your constituents. You're going to be loyal to whoever's going to help you generate a lot of money.
Right.
So I think what you need to do to clean up politics is to get rid of money out of politics, make it illegal for people who serve in Congress to become lobbyists. They can only do it after maybe 5 to 7 years. And then you cannot, none of your kids can work in any sort of capacity. You know, like a lot of senators' kids run consulting firms, and they get a lot of money from companies that have business with their parents' committees, which is ridiculous. So you need to do something like that.
Well, so, I love that you're so like even keel about a lot of this too. And, you know, you have a lot of your political expertise kind of running campaigns, you know, like Senator Barbara Boxer and Bob Graham. And you worked with, Vice President Al Gore's committee on certain campaigns. Tell me how that inside track information kind of either changed your views on politics or how it's run, or even just knowing and seeing the numbers as to how much money is raised and where it's put and how it's spent, when we both know that money could be spent on, you know, building communities in a much better way.
Well, I didn't run any of the campaigns, but I definitely worked in a capacity for Senator Boxer and a few other members of Congress. But I do think, part of the problem is that California is so expensive in terms of buying airtime and advertising. So a lot of that money goes to buying TV time and radio spots. And it's just very, very difficult. I don't know how to either during election years, advertising companies have to provide some sort of discount in terms of if a 30-second spot costs $500,000, you should be able to do it for maybe $100,000 or something. I mean, that's only or you, in a small window, like usually campaign political cycles are every 2 years. So maybe discount the airtime or the cost, you know, I don't know what to do. Otherwise, if you don't lower the cost, it's virtually impossible to make any serious dent. California is so expensive that if you run for the Senate in California, you have to raise at least $20 million.
That's crazy. And no one ever thinks about that. Like, you know, those advertisements aren't swaying voters, you know, at least they don't sway me.
The positive advertisements don't really do anything, but negative advertisements, if you do it correctly, are memorable. No one's going to remember this candidate is a good person. They laugh a lot and they smile and they'll do things for you. No one's going to remember that. But if you say, this person doesn't drink coffee because it thinks it's evil or some other stupid thing, that's how people are going to remember that. And so I think you need to figure out ways to lower the cost, because I think more people would run for office if it wasn't, because a lot of people don't like dialing for money. It's difficult. Some people are very good at it. Some people are very smooth. And when you call people for money, people know what you're calling for because they've given money before. So they say, oh, the office of Senator Boxer or someone else is on the phone. The people who've given money know what you're calling for. They're not asking. They know you're not going to ask them how your day's going. They want to know, can you provide a large check? Would you like to come to this event, be a VIP? Sometimes you have to pander to a donor's vanity, but you know, some people are good at it. Some people are very, very good fundraisers. The Democratic Party has a lot of very, very good fundraisers, but you know, you have to really enjoy it. You know, like I wouldn't want to work in a call center because I don't really want to be yelled at a lot by people when their phone lines don't work. So, you know, some people are very good at it, but that's the only way you can do it is to reduce the money required to run for office. I mean, even corporations should have the freedom. I think there was a Supreme Court case. I can't remember what it was called, but it was essentially to say that giving money for political campaigns is a form of free speech. So it's like protected under the First Amendment. I think Citizens United, I think that was the case, where so they could give unlimited amounts or, you know, relatively high amounts for campaigns. So in order to make it a little more fair, you need to make it harder for corporations or well-heeled individuals to make a big dent. Because most of the money that is spent in politics are all done by billionaires. Like, you know, Mike Bloomberg spent almost $1 billion running for president, and he didn't win a single delegate.
Right.
And it's not fair to people who can't raise that kind of money. So you need to protect people's ability to give money, but you need to reduce it. Like, I think when I was working, I think the most you could give for one election cycle was $4,200, which for an individual is not, but you can give higher amounts to political campaign, like political action committees, the DNC, the RNC, and you can give like 40 or 50,000. I mean, it depends. If it goes into a communal fund, you can give unlimited amounts.
Yeah, I think a lot of those donations are not completely regulated. I think we all know that, you know. Let's switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about something a little bit more pressing. There's a lot of, you know, tensions within races right now. A lot of talk about defunding the police. Tell me what your opinions are like with how we should best defund the police or, you know, just kind of regulate funds to, you know, law enforcement.
I don't think you should defund the police. I wrote a blog post about it. I think you need to reform certain parts about the law enforcement. I think one of the things you need to do is you need to eliminate for-profit prisons. For-profit prisons obviously make a lot of money because people get incarcerated. And so what they do with that money is they pay their executives and they become wealthy, and then they give money to politicians to pass all these laws that most people don't know exist simply to ensnare a lot of people and make them, and then they don't have bail money, and then they have a hard time affording a good lawyer. And then when poor people don't have access to a good lawyer, then they have to go to jail, and that disrupts family. Then Department of Social Services comes and claims their kid. And so you have to, and so when the police are enforcing these draconian laws and these, then the police become the enemy. And so that's part of the problem. And so you need to have more community policing. You need to eliminate for-profit prisons. You need to, nonviolent offenses should be given more chances for rehabilitation. And then you shouldn't have to go to jail if you have parking fees or, you know, I know in San Francisco they have like very reduced shoplifting fines. So if you steal less than $900, the DA won't prosecute, but that doesn't deter people from stealing. But so you need to find, why are people stealing? Is it because of economic, or they're just taunting the law because they know they're going to get away with it? So you need to have better policing. You need to have a better system in place so bad people who become police officers don't, if they get fired, don't get to become police officers in a different department. So there needs to be some sort of database. Like, the, you know, if a background check, I'm sure they do go through some background checks, but there needs to be a uniform system. So if a police officer has a lot of violent interactions with residents of their community, that's something that can be looked into. And cities, because they have a lot of expenses and cities are losing tax revenue because people are moving because it's too expensive. So cities have to find opportunities to make money. And so like in Ferguson, what they did was the police department was the de facto collections agency for the city. And so did generally that affected lower income Americans, including some who were African Americans. So that built that that created a tinderbox of resentment between the police and the community. You want police to be appreciated and needed by the community. And so you have to go after people who are going to be a danger to society. But if people have a hard time paying their bills, you don't need to put them in jail and disrupt their families. So you need to find ways to reduce the influence of for-profit prisons. If you're going to give for-profit prisons money, then you need to they need to show a reduction in violence, you know, a reduction in prisoners. So like people, non-violent prisoners who got into a fist fight at a bar and they knocked someone out, they shouldn't have to spend time in jail. They should, if it's a violent, like armed robbery, other, you know, other violent crimes, you should go to jail. But if it's nothing where you are a danger to society, you have to find ways to kind of rehabilitate people and give people an opportunity to atone for whatever they did.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And it's, you know, like the funny thing is, I saw this interview with, I think it was in the Netherlands, you know, this guy got arrested for a crime. And, you know, the way he served time was not in these like cages, like a metal cage. He was actually put in this, it kind of looked like a cabin, where he had guidance counselors and he had therapists, and they basically rehabilitated these people to get back into society so they could thrive. But the way our system is with all the prisons and jails, it's very much run by capitalists, where it's like they want a for-profit system that they can kind of like, you know, unfortunately kind of, you know, do a little bit of ethnic cleansing or, you know, kind of like increase race wars, because a lot of the people that are, you know, flooding these prisons are African-American, Mexican, there are immigrants, they are coming from, you know, another country or, you know, on the lower economic part of the system. And we're not rehabilitating these people to get back into society and to kind of offer something that...
Well, rehabilitating someone who committed a violent crime would be a little hard, but for people who have committed nonviolent crimes, you should, you know, like if you commit a federal white collar crime, which is like a banking crime or something, you're not serving these very aggressive, mentally challenging prisons. It's a little bit different. So you need to have most prisons like that, you know. You should rehabilitate people so they have atoned for their sins and then you bring them back into society. But because there's so much, the court system is overburdened, the penal code system is overburdened. There's a lot of problems in American society. So it's not just, you can't put all of that and have the police solve those problems. I don't know if you remember, there was a someone who went at and killed 5 Dallas police officers. And the police chief, I can't remember his name. He's now, I think, the police chief of Chicago. But he was saying that everyone gives all of society's problems and makes the police deal with it. So if there's like a domestic violence, the police have to deal with it, and they should. If it's a issue with kids and a divorce, the police have to deal with it. So you're overburdening police with stuff that they don't need to do. And the talking about managing police, it's mostly a political thing. I don't think they're really... are going to do anything. And you can't remove police. You need police. Police are very important. They're vital to quality of life. You just have to have police focus on issues of public safety, meaning dealing with people who are a danger to society. People who are homeless or have drug issues should not be put in prison. You should put them into homeless shelters if they want to be in homeless shelters. or if they have a drug problem, you need to, and I'm sure they do, but some people don't have the money to pay for it. So society has to make a grand bargain and say, well, if we reduce costs for this, we can transfer budget to, you know, to rehabilitate people and give money to cities so people who are nonviolent and show promise that they're not going to be a burden to society and they're not going to endanger themselves or anyone else, give them opportunities to earn a living, and give them, being convicted of a crime, provided it's not a violent felony, you should be able to be rehabilitated and come into society and be successful.
Yeah, I read this thing a long time ago that the Maasai, you know, the tribe in Kenya, what they do, like, let's say somebody in their tribe acts out, maybe they steal something or they do something very bad. The entire tribe gathers around that person and they do like this tribal ceremony where every person tells the person something positive about them to reinforce them. And like, I remember reading that and thinking, there's no way American society or even just like, you know, the world as a whole would ever operate like that. But that is exactly what people need. You know, like, people are going to make mistakes, but there's this sense of judgment and there's this burden of having to live with like a scarlet letter if any crime is committed. I mean, there are crimes committed for marijuana that people are still serving time. And now, you know, it's legalized so, you know, across the country in so many ways for the most part.
And I think the other thing is like the three strikes law. You need to kind of be, you need to be prudent about who you put in prison. People who have petty crimes, you have to figure out, why did you do it? Like you said, like the Maasai, you should say, what exactly is your problem? And then I went to go hear Father Boyle speak, and he deals with a lot of people who are trying to get out of gangs. And he,
yeah, he's the homeboy.
Yeah. A lot of these guys and gals have come from broken homes or abusive parents, and you have to figure out why people do what they do and go after the heart of the issue rather than punishing the crime, which if it's serious, you should, but find out why people are doing it. If people come from broken homes, there needs to be an opportunity for someone to look after them. Like, I know foster kids, because it was, I think it was in the 30s or 40s, they made it illegal for orphanages to exist. So that's what started the foster care system. But there are a lot of people, and so the state gives you money to look after a kid until they turn 18. And then when they age out, then who's going to look after them? So there needs to be something, because if a kid's well-behaved and he's in the foster system, but he's not really loved, and then once he's aged out, he or she ages out, then they'll either get picked up by maybe a gang or other people who don't have their best interests at heart, and then they go into prison. So there has to be something to eliminate that. And I don't know if the state is equipped to handle that, because it's a lot of work, but someone has to step up, or some company has to step up and say, we can do this. It has to be some sort of partnership between private entities or nonprofits and the government. So that's how you have to eliminate crime, and that's how you eliminate that. And then you protect, give people an opportunity to succeed in life, and don't put all the burden on society, on police.
Well, I love that you brought up the homeboy company, because here's somebody that took, you know, a whole bunch of ex-gang members, and some of them were rival gang members, and he created a business, and he created a product that not only rehabilitates these people back into society, but it gives them a place that they can contribute in a positive way. And he created an industry from it. So, like, it, you know, to see that is possible, I think we need more programs like that. Let's talk about the homelessness issues. You know, California deals with it the most. Do you think mental health care has to be, you know, more well-funded to kind of help some of these people that are, you know, in homelessness situations? Is it drugs?
It's a lot of things. I mean, I used to think it was because people were all mentally ill or mentally ill or their drug issues I've listened to a couple of people on YouTube, and one was Tim Pool, and he said, Tim Pool said, a lot of the people that are homeless want to be homeless, not because they enjoy the lifestyle. It's not like, you know, it's not a similar lifestyle. It's much easier for them to be homeless. There are other people who have drug issues And those people have a dependency issue that needs to, so those people need to go through drug treatment. Other people have catastrophic family loss. So if they're by themselves and they don't have family anymore, then they, if that's the horrible burden for one person, male or female or anyone else, to be able to deal with. So a lot of people become homeless because they don't have anyone to look out for them when they have catastrophic family loss. So there's a lot of issues. And usually, you know, homeless is a trendy issue for politicians to care about. I mean, a lot of people have good intentions and they want to do the right thing. But then the government, like City of LA and the State of California, will offer, you know, sort of contracts, and then people take the contracts and they get the money, and then they don't really, you know, the homeless.
Didn't talk about something that's really important amongst that community. It's the PTSD war veterans. You know, like, our country sends these kids to, you know, war zones like Vietnam or Afghanistan or Iraq, and these kids who should be thriving in a community to do something positive are end up getting, you know, shot at or losing friends or just seeing a part of human existence that they shouldn't at that young age, and they never recover from it. And there's no way to rehabilitate these people. I mean, you're
sending kids to war between the ages of 18 and like mid 20s. And, you know, it's very hard to see what they've seen and under the stress environments and then come home. And then society will tell them, oh, we love you, thank you for serving, and then they don't really do anything. So
right. You
have to, again, it doesn't have to be government, but the government could provide money, and then a nonprofit would have to have strict enforcement with someone, and then they would have strict enforcement, and they would do an opportunity, they would provide an opportunity for these guys to be rehabilitated. I thought
Otis is saying hello. Do you see that? You see him? Anyways, I agree with you.
What we have to do is to pull these guys out of Afghanistan and Iraq and war zones, end those wars, and then provide them opportunities like a partnership between the government and a nonprofit or a private agency that wants to provide them healthcare, mental health, and, you know, it's serving in war. I mean, I've never served it myself, but I'm sure it stays with you forever. Like Oliver Stone served in Vietnam, and Vietnam stays with him. So you have to find an opportunity, lifetime mental health and support for all these people who go serve in wars. So
yeah, I had a teacher in high school. I remember Coach Noah, and he served in Vietnam, and he said anytime he heard a balloon pop, you know, in a restaurant or whatever, it was never a positive experience. And he talked about his PTSD. And, you know, it's like there's a lot of soldiers that come back from these places and they don't recover. There's a high suicide rate. There's a high homelessness rate amongst veterans. So, yeah. And I think the illusion, too, sometimes is like, you know, the government kind of offers an opportunity for so many young people to go into the military to give them maybe a little bit of guidance or, you know, kind of some security. But it doesn't always turn out that way for a lot of people. You know, it's like it just the variables are so different with every person that joins. So I just I want to see the system change so much between the prisons and, you know, the military and education. It feels like our priorities are just a little bit skewed. How do you think we can kind of get back to, you know, kind of like a more wholesome way of looking and treating citizens as one family or within the family?
I mean, it's difficult to get everyone to love each other like a Barney video, but I think people need to stop watching TV, stop watching cable news, put down their phones, and find ways to interact with other people, because it's kind of absurd to think that you're only going to deal with people who agree with you on everything. So it's a very childish belief. You know, if like I wholeheartedly endorse, you know, people being able to marry whoever they want. And some religious folks don't want to allow people to get married in their churches. And that should be fine. Like, if you allow people to get married, the state should recognize it. But people, you know, based on religious beliefs, as long as those religious beliefs aren't a cover for discrimination and bigotry, you should find some sort of common ground.
But, you know, it kind of does. It does lend itself towards discrimination. And, you know, I never really thought that, you know, I remember, you know, reading the lyrics for Imagine by John Lennon. And so many things he talked about, I kind of argued with, like, no religion, no countries, no borders. And I was like, oh, man, this guy does not have a clue. And as I get older, I'm like, oh, my God, this guy had all the right clues. Because anything that separates or causes, you know, judgment or, you know, tries to dictate the way somebody should live is not the way. You know, it's like, I think there's got to be more acceptance, you know, within society, within each citizen. And it's like, you have to, you know, kind of, you know, try to be more compassionate to one another. And I feel like that gets lost and that gets skewed within the, you know, overzealous religious, you know, zealots, you know, or, you know, the right wing or left wing. I mean, I feel like any extremist in any field can be detrimental to society, but there's got to be a way we can kind of bring people back to kind of like values. What do you think? Where do you think that comes from?
I think it ultimately comes down with, again, stop watching cable news and, you know, you don't have to agree with everyone's perspective, but you should at least hear them out and find some common ground, because the government was designed for distribution of power. So the executive, the White House, the executive branch controls the military and sets policy. Congress controls the money. And the judiciary, the Supreme Court, determines whether anything that was done by the president or Congress goes against the Constitution. So the government was designed for distribution of power. So it means that one group is not going to control everything. So going out through life where you're going to agree with everyone and only work with people who agree with you, it's kind of unrealistic. And part of the reason why everything is so tribal now is that people only want to hear what they want to hear and don't want to be. And part of that is kids are coddled in school. You know, no one teaches life lessons anymore. No one understands how government works. People are more interested in getting ideas from Twitter, social media, and
late night culture. Yeah.
Pop culture. And so those are ways to divide people. So just, I think the best thing to do is to teach people news and social media and go out and meet with people and understand that you try to find common ground. But the government also, the Constitution also gives states a lot of rights. And the government only steps in and anything and supersedes anything the states do if it violates the Constitution or, you know, federal mandates, that sort of thing. So states have a lot of rights. States have the ability to determine how they want to run themselves. So you're giving power back to the people on some level. So there are a lot of issues that not everyone's going to agree with. So, you know, I think you need to find some sort of way to understand and teach people that you're not going to get everything you want in life. You're not going to get everyone agree with you. So you need to find some common ground so society can move forward and function and evolve without being so tribal. Because right now, I think both political parties and the media companies that are aligned with the political parties and the mega donors and the corporations that are aligned with all of them are feeding this distrust and anger towards each other. So people need to stop watching those. They need to have an open mind and understand that the government was designed for conflict on some level, not warfare, but, you know, the Congress and the executive branch will have issues and disputes have to be settled by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court's not supposed to take sides, but impartial judgment on an issue. And so I think the one of the ways you have to teach the children when they're younger that you're not going to get everything you want. You're going to have to work with people you may not agree with. And that starts at a younger age. And,
right.
And then you also need to tell people, learn about the news by going to reputable sources and reading, and don't watch TV for your information, because the TV will tell you what they want you to hear.
Right. Let's talk about something that's pretty pressing. Let's talk about all the COVID signals, the pandemic, or what do you think are the ways that it's going to kind of...
I think it's like everything, it's political now. So if President Trump says something, the Democrats will be opposed to it. The Democrats want, like, mandatory mask policy, but there have been instances like Nancy Pelosi and Dianne Feinstein, who was walking through an airport without a mask. So you need to be uniform. So it cannot be what's good for thee is not for me or whatever, you know? So everyone has to have, and I think people should wear masks until it's proven that masks are not needed or there's a vaccine. I think you need to have social distancing. So like all the restaurants now where I live all have these barricades that, you know, and then the barricades are on one side of the street, or they're on the street, and they allow restaurants to put tables out on the other side of the barricades. So I think that's going to be the norm for a while. And I think you need to stop being – people need to stop being political. Like when medical organizations say people need to have social distancing, but if it's for a BLM rally, you can go ahead and go to the BLM rally. So it needs to be uniform. Medicine should never be political. That's why in Afghanistan, army doctors were taking care of wounded American troops and the Taliban who were shooting at them, because that's the ethical thing to do. You have to treat people who are wounded and hurt. And you cannot not treat people because they're Trump supporters or because they're Biden supporters. You have to, medicine has to be ethical and neutral. That's how medicine, because once medicine becomes infected by politics, we're all in trouble.
Let's talk about, we just lost a very great justice, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You know, and this seat that now is an open seat could be appointed by President Trump. How do you think this situation should best be handled? Do you think Trump is justified to have to appoint the new justice? Do you think it should wait till after the election? What is the most fair and just way to kind of fill that next seat?
Well, I mean, Trump is the president and the Republicans control the Senate. And if the roles were reversed, the Democrats would ram a justice through. I mean, he can do it because he's legally allowed to. Should he? Probably not. But, you know, in this politically charged environment and that where the people are going to contest the election, if it comes to it, you need to have nine justices. And because if it doesn't, what happens is if there's no president chosen by January 20th, then Nancy Pelosi becomes president. And so you need to have the job of the judiciary is to impart rulings on to protect the Constitution. Like if I was president and it wasn't so tribal, I would wait until the incoming Congress. But Trump was within his legal ability to do so, but I wouldn't do it personally.
You know, I love talking about all this stuff with you because you always shed so much light on things and have sources of information that, you know, you mentioned so many people I didn't even know existed, man. Where can people find your blog? Your blog is one of the biggest reasons I wanted to promote you tonight. But, I wanted to talk about politics so people can hear your views. And where can people find, you know, your blog if they want to read
it? They can go to Hero, HEROOFTHE, the number 7, the word galaxies.blogspot.com.
Hero of the 7 galaxies.blogspot.com. And give us a meaning behind the name.
I just wanted something, it wanted to sound funny. It didn't no real meaning. I'm not a real hero of any galaxy, but.
Wasn't it a Bush reference? I thought it was a Bush reference.
That was like, I think, Center for Strategery.
Yes.
I didn't think that was really going to be. So here are the 7 galaxies. It's not to take me seriously, but hopefully if I write on certain subjects, people can get a grasp of what issues are and they can then do their own research and come to a conclusion. So it's basically to plant a seed and kind of have some sort of ideas and discussions about certain things. And sometimes I'll do restaurant reviews, but my passion is like current events and kind of figuring out, you know, my own personal take on something. But, you know, I love to eat too. And
you and me both, bro. Well, dude, Anish, you've been a great guest, a fantastic guest. You're a pretty great political analyst, but you're an even better older brother, bro. And I look forward to tennis. I look forward to movies and some food with you soon.
I was disappointed you had no sound effects on my time on your show.
Well, you know what? We'll bring you back. We'll bring you back into the studio next time because I will definitely have the sound effects ready and armed when you come into the studio, okay?
All right, man. Well, it was fun talking. Stay safe and stay informed. And, you know, maybe in a couple of weeks, go play tennis.
I'm ready, man. And I'm getting it on the record. I love you, man. I want to hear it. I want to hear it back.
I love you, too.
All right, man. Have a good night, okay?
Have everyone at your house. And I'll talk to you soon, all right?
All right, man. Be good, bro.
All right. You, too.
Peace.
Late.